Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Two Norries podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined as always by my good friend, Timmy Lamb.
Hi, everyone.
And
our today, guest, me and James are from the same jumpers, if you haven't noticed.
We have. So we went to a corporate event today dressed in the same clothes. So,
that was interesting.
The Two Norries uniform. But our guest today is Sinead Gibney, the Chief Commissioner for the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission.
Bang on.
And you have a rake of titles as well. Like, we met at the Gashka Awards. We hosted Gashka Awards. It was around specifically around the Criminal Justice Awards.
Yeah.
And it was in the Google headquarters. It was an amazing venue, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a fab venue. And I used to work in Google, so it was kind of weird for me coming back. Just, yeah,
a 360 view of Dublin.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
From the penthouse. But that was where we got to meet. But when I was introducing you, you were about six masters or something.
Two masters. Then three... other postgraduate qualifications, So I'm an absolute, I'm an addict. I love learning, and I will continue to do masters and courses as long as I live.
Yeah,
I love them.
Can I ask you a question around that? Because this is coming from somebody that finds it difficult to the educations. How is it, just the learning thing? Can you sit down and read? Is there no problem? Have you no issues with any of that?
No, I do. Like, I hate it when I'm in it. Like, I hate moments of it. And I hate a lot of the fact that you have to sacrifice your Monday and Tuesday evenings or whatever it is that you do when you get into the routine of it. But I love I just love the exploration, and I love it as a way to, I mean, I did my bachelor degree, my first degree in the 90s, like when I left school. And then all of the other qualifications I've done while I'm working full time, and most of them while I was taking care of my daughter. I'm a single mum, you know. So it was an escape for me as well as anything else, and a kind of an intellectual space to explore different ideas that allowed me to enjoy my work more and to detach from work and other areas of life a bit more. So it's not that I find it easy, but one thing I will say is they get easier. Like, my second master's was a whole just different ball game compared to the first one, because you get to see that with any of these learning experiences, you get as much out of it as you can put into it. Yeah. And when you're working full time, the reality is you cannot read every single academic paper. And sometimes you can just read the introduction and the concluding remarks or the concluding observations or whatever. And that's enough, you know, and like, you have to be realistic with that. But one master's I did in particular, the second one, was absolutely life changing. It was the Equality Studies master's in UCD. And I recommend it for anybody because it will absolutely shift your thinking. It teaches critical thinking in a way that was utterly new to me and kind of really ultimately helped me to leave the private sector and move into the public sector, where I've found a much more rewarding career than I ever could have in the private sector.
So before we get into the career and all the stuff you're doing today, we'll take us back to where are you from and what was it like growing up?
So I'm from Dublin, although I grew up in England for a few years. My dad was an academic, so I was made in Australia, actually, and my mum was 7 months pregnant coming back to Ireland with me, and then 6 months old when they moved to Southampton. Grew up there for 7 years. Don't remember a whole lot of it, weirdly. I don't know what that is. And then been back in Dublin since. And
were you always bright in school?
I was a trier compared to, like, my sister was very, she was head girl and all of that sort of stuff. I struggled a bit more in school. I was a bit rebellious and, didn't always land on the right side of the teachers, if you know what I mean. So
just don't.
Yeah. Company here. Yeah.
But I thrived in college, I have to say, and I did. I ended up being president of my students' union. I loved college. I went to college up north and Coleraine. And it was fab because, I mean, other than that, I've lived in South County Dublin.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe just to say that, to check my own privilege, I come from a, you know, an affluent, white, settled family.
Most natural thing in the world for you to go to university.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally was. But it was also a big experience for me because it was away from home, whereas a lot of my friends in South Dublin went to UCD or Trinity, stayed friends with the people they were friends with, stayed living with their parents.
Yeah.
I was uprooted and in...
Was it George Heist to do that?
Yeah, kind of. I missed missed the course I wanted in Trinity. And there was a really good history school in University of Ulster. My sister was already there, so that made it a little easier. And
so you did history?
I did history in my primary degree, yeah.
Okay, and what kind of history would you have been interested in?
It was modern and contemporary history, and I specialised, and the area I was really interested in was the development of political thought. So socialism, essentially. Like I did my thesis on how the information revolution was going to affect the development of socialism, and I had this great idea that basically it would level everything, that when we all had access to education and information, it would be such a leveler. Like, this is in the late 90s now, before the internet really, we understood what it was going to be.
Yeah.
Not that we still do, but...
Oh, yeah. And so that was your first degree?
Yeah.
What did you do then? Did you go into the private sector working, or...?
I jumped around a bit. I've had a real patchwork quilt of a career, if I'm honest, like, and I started in public relations, and then I moved into the NGO sector. I had my baby, and came out of work for a couple of years when I had her. And when I came back in, then I was in the NGO sector very briefly, and then in academic institutions, but not in academic roles, just running projects and different things like that. And then I got a job in Google, which was just an amazing opportunity.
What role was it?
So the role I went into was learning and development. I basically built up a team of people who developed e-learning solutions for internally, mostly. And but when I went in, I was always intent on getting into a more philanthropic role.
Yeah.
That's what I was interested in. And I was very fortunate that I was able to. And while I was there, the leadership within Google Ireland essentially created a new role. And I got it and got a teammate as well. So.
You know, the philanthropic role, explain a little bit about that for some people.
Yeah. So in places like Google, I mean, it's a big multinational, and within the company, there's lots of ways in which staff volunteer and the company donates money. And so those philanthropic and voluntary activities, they're handled different ways in different offices across the world. So they didn't have anybody in Dublin to essentially manage it, and a huge staff in Dublin. And there was just a lot of interest, you know, both amongst the leadership within the company, but also the staff. You've got a very young, energetic staff who are just interested in different causes. So that's essentially what I did, was I built up a team called Social Action, we called it, but it was what most people would know as corporate social responsibility.
Yeah.
And we did things a little differently, I would say, because one of the things you find with CSR, corporate social responsibility, is that a lot of companies, it's quite self-regulating and in many cases self-serving. I don't have a problem with self-serving, but it's not always very well... it's not results driven.
Yeah.
So oftentimes if it's results driven, it's much more about kind of creating opportunities for the staff rather than thinking about what you're actually doing for society. So we wanted to do that differently, and the leadership in Dublin were with me on that. So we brought in two kind of key principles, which was that we would engage the staff at the top of their skill set as much as we could. So we didn't want people who had degrees coming out there, whatever's, and languages and everything else, going painting houses, because, like, you know, that you can just put their skills to much better use. And then also that we would only that we would focus on a specific issue, because what you find with CSR programs and social responsibility generally is you know, a company will pick a theme, like, say, education, and then they'll just do a whole smorgasbord of activities related to education. What we wanted to do was really look at a social issue and think about it as you would any other business problem. So we looked at specifically internet engagement for older people. And I had targets around, I had to reach 3,000 people through education initiatives, 6,000 people through awareness initiatives, whatever it was. I'm picking them out of my head now, but it was something like that. And, you know, and that's what we did. So we tested models and, you know, built stakeholders. We brought together a coalition of groups who were all working in digital inclusion and in older people's rights. And then we also worked with government to try and tell them, well, we've tested these out. Here's how we think you can look at digital inclusion. Because still, I would say, and certainly at the time, when the state in this jurisdiction and in other states as well, when they look at digital inclusion, they tend to think about it from an employment point of view, jobs creation. And whilst that's really important, we were looking at it much more around social exclusion and the digital divide. And I think we're all at a better understanding of what that means this side of COVID, but it's still a massive, massive issue. Yeah. So, it was a really, I was really privileged to be in that role in Google where, it's, you know, there's not many jobs like that in a company like
it's
Google.
It's interesting to hear the level of detail that went behind the corporate social. I was a part of a charity before, and there was this big company. They wanted, basically, what it was they had a certain amount of hours that their employees could donate to the charity. But the charity then feel obliged to take them on, but it actually costs you money to take them on because you have to look after them, and you know, you have to, you can't just leave them on their own, you know. But then you, like when you're in the charity, you never say no to anything like that because you're trying to keep the relationship for down the line. But it's great that with Google there was more thought went into it. And
we were really determined to battle against that, exactly that. And that was hard in an American multinational, because that is very much a cultural thing from America. Like, that is how CSR is handled in America. I mean, I've heard stories about NGOs in America where they'll take on teams of corporate, you know, away days or whatever to paint a school building. Yeah. They'll have the same building painted 20 times in a month. So that
you just find stuff for them to do. It's not really a value to you. But as an NGO, you feel like you have to kind of take the offer.
Yeah,
another offer might come down the line. It might be financially, you know, blah blah blah.
Well, also because the other reason they'll do it, certainly in America, I don't know about here, but is because they want to. They know that those people are people who earn money and who will donate. If you go out and paint the school for a charity, you're much more likely to donate to that charity. So they'll do it sometimes at an expense, knowing that they'll get a little bit of return in terms of donations. Yeah. But it's ridiculous. Like, it's, I mean, and you know, one of the directors who I worked with said that if one person in the company can cure cancer, that's our program. Like, obviously, we're not going to make 3,000 people feel good about themselves when you can have a much more targeted impact. But nonetheless, actually, we did have huge levels of staff engagement, and we did our best to deploy people in ways that were meaningful. So, you know, helping NGOs to develop online marketing programs, because that's what most of our staff do in their day-to-day work. One of the things we never really got going was tapping into the translation skills. Like, there's 60-odd languages in the building.
Yeah.
And we were trying to just find ways, but it was hard, you know, but I think now actually there's probably more potential for it, you know, with a lot of the challenges that we're seeing with new communities settling into Ireland, where multinationals have all of those languages in the building to help with that, you know, and those translation skills are needed in really crucial situations.
Do you know, when you were, when we met you up in Gashka, you said to me that you had your own issues with alcohol as well.
Yes.
And that you admired what we were doing, which was lovely to hear.
Yeah.
But I think it's good that somebody with your status and your position, because people might think that, like, somebody like you would have it all easy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But, like, it doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, we can all struggle, can't we?
Yeah, totally. And I think it's so important to name it, you know, and I think I said at the time, like, you know, we're so far ahead now in terms of discussing mental health than where we were a decade or two ago. We're just not there with alcohol and addiction. And every family in Ireland is touched by addiction in some way or other, you know, either close to you or a little further away. So, yeah, I mean, we've had plenty of it in my family. And 11 years ago now, on New Year's Eve, I chose to give up drink. And at the time I was giving it up for 18 months, I was doing one of those masters, and I was working in Google in that role, and I had my daughter. So I was just like a huge amount of demands on my time. And I just recognized that I was, like, whenever I had time with Bella, my daughter, I was hungover, you know, I mean, or like, I just didn't have enough quality time with her. So I decided to give up for 18 months, and essentially so that I could do one of everything and then something, like, you know, a date sober, a holiday sober, you know, whatever, a Christmas sober. And then, but within, I think, about 12 months, I knew that I would never drink again. It was just one of the best things I ever did.
There's something very great to take from that. you know, when people give up alcohol or drugs, they give it up forever.
Yeah.
I'm giving this up.
Yeah.
Do I have to give it up forever? It's like, if you can do that, I'm giving it up today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll give it up for the week. You know, and you said that you had a number, I'm going to give it up. But in that meantime, you started to notice that your life was getting better.
Yeah.
You were feeling better. You were noticing things that you'd never noticed before. And you were appreciating them. Because that's how it happened.
There's a lot of pain as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And Yes, there was. And the 18 months was interesting because when it's like, and people, you know, obviously this time of year, people have done Dry January and some people have extended it a bit further. But I think when you're giving up for a number of weeks, although of course any period without alcohol is good for just refreshing, no matter who you are, no matter how much you drink.
Yeah.
But you're essentially only waiting until you can drink again. Whereas 18 months is a little more, I felt like it just was going to give me a flavor of what life was like without alcohol. And I did, like, I think within a month had a pretty tough time dealing with, you know, as they say, you take away the painkillers, you feel the pain. And, you know, I speak addiction speak now. I understand it. I didn't immediately access addiction services. I about 9 months later went to an addiction therapist, and he was fab. And I'm a big fan of therapy anyway. And like most of my therapy experiences, we didn't really talk about my addiction much or deal with it necessarily. But he was skilled enough to help me through that period. But then a few years later, I ended up starting AA meetings, and I actually just, I found such, I didn't go for long. I went for about 2.5 years, and it was honestly, it was a time in my life when I couldn't really afford therapy.
Yeah. It's the best thing. There's nothing wrong with that, because they're in every community.
Yeah.
Every day, there's no waiting lists, there's no assessments. You'll go in, you'll sit down, and people will look after you.
Yeah, and it was a lovely, it was a lovely place that I found, where there was a real kind of, you know, people who were there a long time. So there wasn't kind of the same white knuckle you might find at some of the meetings. It was very relaxed, and people talking about the value of sobriety in their lives. And one of the things that really struck me in AA was I saw men being warm to each other and caring in a way that I don't see in any other setting.
That's a beautiful thing.
It's amazing. And it really is that fellowship. Like,
you know, even that 12-step program, like, that's a great way for anybody to live their life as well.
Yeah.
Not just people who are caught up in addiction, but across the board, people who just want to improve their lives.
Yeah.
You know, look at themselves, look at some behaviours that they don't want in their lives anymore. Maybe look at an area of their life where they may have hurt somebody and they want to go back and make an amends, you know, or they want to bring some spirituality into their lives.
Yeah.
It's great for that.
Yeah.
And it's for everybody, not just people caught up in addiction. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah. And I didn't do any of the steps. I did take part in the meetings and I shared and all of that, but I didn't do the 12 steps. I may do them at some stage in my life, you know. And I mean, people in my life would be surprised to hear me talk about addiction, and I remember people saying to me when I gave up drinking, but Sinead, you're such a fun drunk, you know. And I remember one other friend said to me when I told him it was 18 months, and he said, okay, I'll see you in 18 months. And, you know, so like, people will be surprised to hear me talk about it, but like, I've made peace with it. And you know, I know it's hard when you do step away from it to maintain those friendships, because you know, that was one of the first things I learned was we are friends as a peer group because we all drink at a certain level, you know.
Do you know because the podcast that I host with Timmy is a recovery based podcast. Timmy's my friend, he's in recovery. My wife Jillian's in recovery, all my friends are in recovery, and I'm open about it, you know.
Yeah.
So people don't come up and ask me, do you want to have a pint?
Yeah.
Is it difficult for you being at conferences or events and stuff like that to kind of like say no to the wine, and people might be kind of going, sure, you know, after a long day? Is it difficult for you in social settings?
Not really, to be honest. I'm so on sure footing with it now, you know, and I'm very happy to just quite quickly let people know that I'm not a drinker, you know. I'll at functions and stuff, I'll just tell them, please take away the wine glasses, because otherwise it's not even that I'm just worried, it's just like, stop hassling me for wine, I don't want any.
Yeah.
But no, the harder thing for me was that kind of, I mean, the way I describe it was my friendship landscape changed.
Yeah.
And I've kept in my life the people who are important in my life, and but I see them in very different ways, and I see a lot of people a lot less than I ever did, you know, and than I did when we were drinking together, because, you know, they do, many of them still would have similar patterns as when I was drinking, and I just, there's, you know,
not in common anymore.
No, exactly.
That's
yeah.
it. Like, there's nothing yeah. different about it.
But that, yeah. that can be a huge driver yeah. for people to go back. To
yeah, exactly.
You know, feeling
yeah.
that disconnectedness and that isolation, yeah. you know, it's like, especially if all their friends that they've grown up with are still doing the same
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
And you haven't quite got the new friends yet. That's a difficult space yeah. to hold, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
And I was in Google at the time, and it was actually really interesting, because in Google, even, you know, just having the eyes of people who are not Irish, like, you know, because it was only at the time, I think about a quarter of the workforce in Google Ireland was Irish. So, you know, having, and a lot of them, you know, feed into the same commentary, you know, oh, sure, the Irish are great crack and all of that, but they also, you know, are taken aback at the volume of drink, and, you know, and so having that was helpful, and also having a friend group, essentially, you know, yeah. within my colleagues who did other things, related activities,
civilized
yeah.
stuff,
yeah, like daytime things, and you know, I signed up at the time to a few of those, like Hello Sunday Morning is a great email. I mean, I never really got too into any of them, but, and there's loads since. I feel there's a lot more since, like the Soberistas, and there's a lot more resources for people. And I think there's more options, like, you know, because, I mean, looking back now, like, I still think abstinence was the only way I was ever going to stop drinking. And for me, it's just so much easier than considering,
yeah.
like, having a glass or two. Just, I just don't see the need, you know. Yeah. But I do think that's not the case for everybody. I get that,
yeah, of course not.
You know,
of course
there's
other
not. Models.
But you made a good point, and Timmy said as well, like, if people are listening and they're contemplating it, just give yourself the week, or give yourself a milestone.
Yeah.
Maybe get to Easter, and then you'll review it at Easter, and then maybe try and get over the summer. And when I was in rehab, the residential side of it, the thought of, like, not drinking was, like, daunting for me, because I used to say I'm a drug addict, I'm not, the alcohol is not my problem. But the counsellor says to me, give yourself 12 months.
Yeah.
And then after 12 months, if you feel you want to have a drink, then go and have a drink. Yeah. So then it was like, that was manageable.
Yeah.
And then after 12 months, I looked at how my life was after changing
yeah.
and all the opportunities I had. It's like, I'm not giving that. Drink isn't that good.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. It's overrated. Yeah. That is one of the key lessons that I learned quite quickly was, and I would say that to anybody, it is overrated, and it's only when you step away from it that you see that.
Yeah.
And what's the first thing we think of when we face some adversity in our lives? Do you know, if something really is... What is it? Drink.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or something good happens. Reward. Like, it's
drink.
The same. Yeah, yeah,
it's drinking. You, like, it's all about catching that thinking as well, and becoming aware that if you're off the drink and you're in recovery,
yeah,
you have to understand that the minute something difficult pops up in your life, maybe something goes wrong in the family, or someone dies, or something just doesn't go your way, and it's upsetting you, and you're feeling a lot of pain internally, the mind will automatically tell you, let's go to the pub. Let's get a bag or whatever. You know, so it's very important for people to understand how the mind works as well around addiction, you know, because when you are facing some form of difficulty in your life, your mind will click straight into that and it'll look at the easiest way to get the pain away.
Exactly.
And that's drink or drugs.
Do you know when you left the private sector?
Yeah.
And what was it? Like, you're a human rights, you're the chief commissioner on the Human Rights and Equality Commission now.
Yeah.
How did you end up in that role?
Again, it was not quite straightforward, if you like. I mean, I left Google essentially with not knowing what I was going to do. Like, I didn't have the IREC job when I left Google. And I left, you know, kind of thinking, I had some ideas around what I wanted to do, setting up by myself and do consultancy type stuff. And then quite quickly, the director job came up in IREC, and I went for it. Didn't think I'd get it, and I did. And I was probably a little bit of a surprise appointment for some people. But I mean, just to give you a little bit of an explanation of the organisation, because it's quite complicated from a governance point of view, or from how we're organised. So the chief commissioner is one of 15 commission members. And we're all appointed by President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, and we are independent officers of the state. And IREC is the national human rights institution for Ireland, and we're recognised by the UN as being an a-status body, which means that we are independent enough and we're resourced enough to hold the state to account on its human rights and equality obligations. And but obviously we can't do that alone, so we have to have a team of people to do that. And at the moment we have 90 staff, and they're headed up by the director, and they are civil servants, and they have to be essentially because they're state employees. But nonetheless, we are accountable directly to the Oireachtas. So it's complicated because you have to build within essentially the state infrastructure a mechanism by which you can still hold the state to account. So I came in as director, and I came in at a time when we were merging two former bodies, the Equality Authority and the Irish Human Rights Commission. And they needed somebody. I think, you know, the reason I did get the job was because they needed somebody who was just, you know, had good management skills and was able to build up the organization. And I came from Google, where I'd learned so much in terms of all of that, good management structures and, you know, strategic planning and all of those kinds of skills. So that's how I came in as director. And I mean, I just absolutely loved it. I did the role for 2.5 years, and it didn't quite pan out in the way that I thought. So, I mean, I was very proud of what I did in the time that I was there in that role, but essentially felt it was the right time for me to move. And this time I did start working for myself, and yeah, I did all sorts of things. I did media production. I ran for election. I did training, facilitation. I ended up in Mountjoy actually at that stage facilitating a session, brilliant session between Mountjoy and Maynooth when they were building their programme together. So just did all sorts of stuff, and then went for the chief commissioner gig it was 2019. I was appointed in 2020. But again, you know, I mean, I don't mind saying these things. I didn't think I'd get it. You know, again, as chief commissioner.
Such a high position. What's the interview like? Like, is there a tree on the panel? Do you have to go back for a second interview? Do you have to do presentations?
Yes, you do. Yeah. Yeah. When I was, for both of them, they were, so for the director one, there was actually 5, for the chief commissioner, only 4 on the panel. And yeah, there are 2 interviews each, and the second one would normally have, both of them had presentation components. So, I mean, I'm pretty good at interviews, I think.
Sounds like it. After getting some good roles, like, down through the years, fair play. But it's a skill, isn't it?
It is a skill, and I've taught interviewing skills, both to people who interview and who are being interviewed. So I've done a lot around that space, so I think, I was well positioned.
Yeah, I've a few, my last 3 or 4 interviews I've done, I think I did really well and I got the positions. But there's a few disasters at the start, you know, when you just come out of college and you're a bit green.
Yeah.
But it's just something that you have to have the experience, and you can't buy that experience, you know.
Yeah.
Make sure yourself, embarrass yourself, but you won't do that the second time.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to, I mean, you have to be yourself, you have to relax in them. And I really feel for people who struggle with interviews and who are nervous in interviews, because I can see sometimes in interview situations, and I've done a lot of interviewing, like when I was director, we were building up the team. So, I mean, I think I'd quantified it at the time. I did something like 200 interviews and placed 35 people, reviewed about 1,000 CVs. So, like, you know, seeing what people do when they sit in that chair is just fascinating. I mean, that is a study on humanity. And I really feel for people, like, and I do find as well that, you know, as an interviewer, what I try and do is just make people feel at ease and just create the conditions for them to be their best selves and present their best selves. But unfortunately, not all interviewers are trained to do that. Some interviewers are actually quite nervous themselves. They might not be that skilled at it.
Yeah.
And that, I think, sometimes doesn't help, where they will make somebody feel nervous and, you know.
We were at a corporate event today. We spoke at a corporate event, a big private company. And they asked us, what can they do in terms of their processes around interviewing people with convictions and stuff like that, because it is very daunting when you're in an interview. You know the question is coming. What advice would you give for interviewers in terms of how they would phrase the question, how they would go about it?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm a big believer in the competency-based interviewing model, and or honestly, if not that, then some model, like, have a structure for your interviews and communicate that structure to your candidates in some shape or form. That's why public sector interviewing is very positive, because it's a clear framework and you know how to master it essentially before you sit in the chair. So now, not everybody does do that, but so as interviewers, but like, really be quite explicit in, you know, I'd always say to somebody, you know, you're here for the interview for this job. We're going to talk to you about these competencies and we're all going to ask you questions on it if there's multiple people in the room. You'll have the chance to ask questions at the end. Now, best of luck in the interview. And I always finish with that phrase because I want people to know that we're rooting for you, you know. And I think as interviewers, you can do that and smile at people and make eye contact. Like, it's amazing how, like I say, interviewers themselves get very nervous and they don't do that. And when you, if you're like looking, you know, taking notes and looking down, people just lose their kind of connection with you, and they just don't, you know, they don't show their best. The
interviewer needs to be confident in what
they
ask and say, look, it's just, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
If there's something there, but some, most of the time they don't really ask at interview level. If you're being offered the job, then it might come up then. But like a real champion for people like ourselves is Lynn Ruane, Senator Lynn Ruane in this area. What do you think around spent convictions? And do you think like that, the bit of spent convictions for road traffic and public order after 7 years, do you think that all offences should come under there, or some, or how would you approach it?
Well, IRECA's put out a policy statement on this in 2020, and we do think that there should be a ground, essentially, for, you know, a discrimination ground for criminal convictions. And absolutely, we think that the spent convictions, our position is that it needs to be reviewed to be much more expansive, essentially, you know, taking account of multiple sentences, for example, and for the thresholds to be reviewed, because at the moment they're just too restrictive for people, many people, to be able to access. And I know Lynn, Senator Ruane, has done a lot of work, and there's legislation on it at the moment. But the other place we're currently working on this is in the future or the equality legislation review. So the Department of Equality is currently reviewing all equality legislation and looking at the grounds, but also about the framework of how people access equality legislation, which is the key way in which people combat and deal with discrimination here in Irish society. And we think that there should be an additional ground of criminal conviction. So that would mean that people can be essentially pursued for discriminating against somebody because they have a criminal conviction. And that wouldn't necessarily, but this isn't, you know, this is something we're deliberating on at the moment, and we haven't come to an exact position on it. But that doesn't necessarily just mean spent convictions either. That could potentially mean that you could find a way to combat discrimination for people who have convictions around, you know, even within the confines of disclosure, for example.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Or whatever it might be, but find ways in which basically, I mean, you know, to facilitate rehabilitation and to help with, you know, people integrating into society after after they've served their sentence.
Like, for people like myself and Timmy, we've spoken to a lot of prisoners over the last few weeks. They can do all they can in terms of attending, doing personal development and therapy and courses and degrees and all this stuff, but society has a role and provide meaningful employment.
Yeah.
Because if they do all this stuff to move away from that, because when you think about it, if somebody goes to prison, they have to get out at some stage.
Yeah.
And everybody, even lifers, get out as well. So you have to, like, society has to think, right, what do we want? We want for that person to not commit crime again.
Yeah.
Well, you don't do that by blocking them from employment. Because that's breeding ground for recidivism and reoffending, you know.
Yeah.
So there is a role for society to give people opportunities. And when you think about, like, what they can bring to the table as well, you know, the determination, the goal setting.
Absolutely, the resilience.
Leadership, resilience, all this stuff, you know.
Yeah. While we were doing the talks in the prisons for the last few weeks, one of the biggest questions that we got back was the Garda vetting process for a lot of prisoners, because they're they're actually worried because a lot of them have probably been off drugs in prison for the first time in their lives, and they have a bit of clarity, and they're probably understanding that
exactly
I have three kids at home, I have a wife at home, they need me, I need to get home and get a job. Yeah. And they're understanding, geez, how can I get a job? Should they go through the vetting process? And then that kind of knocks them back down to the bottom of the pile again. Yeah. You know, we need to...
It needs to be laser precise. That's what I like. You know, I appreciate there has to be Garda vetting, but it should be absolutely, you know, specific to the area or the potential crime or whatever. You know what I mean? There has to be a clear reason why somebody is Garda vetted, not to participate in a particular activity. And that, I mean, because I think, you know, we can go down one route or we can go down the other. And I mean, if you look at America now, you have, I mean, essentially ghettoized people who are post-incarceration because they are so restricted from, you can't, there's 400 meters from this place or, you know, whatever else. Like you're finding...
Can't even vote in some states.
Yeah, yeah, in most states. And I mean, you're literally corralled into, I mean, physically a neighborhood whereby you're not going to infringe on any sanctions. But also then, of course, like you're just not able to engage in society. Mm. You're not able to participate. So I do think we have to recognize the importance of a mechanism like Garda vetting for public safety. I fully accept that, but it has to be done proportionately, and it has to be done with laser precision for the reality, and not just kind of blanket, oh, we'll Garda vet because, and you know, like insert name of profession here. That's not how we go about it.
Certain employers use it as a filtering tool.
Exactly.
They filter out that employee.
Yeah.
And that's very disheartening. Yeah. I've had a few bad experiences now, and interestingly, they were volunteer roles.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I was looking, and they were in the criminal justice world as well, the NGOs, and or else an organisation brought in by a criminal justice organisation. Now, I have spent time in prison. My Garda vetting doesn't come back blank. There's a couple of pages there, but there's nothing there. Crimes against children, or sex crimes, or arson is a big one as well. So, like, it's not relevant.
Yeah, exactly.
But, like, I'm 10 years away from that lifestyle. Yeah. I have a bachelor's degree, I have a master's degree, I have a world of personal development done.
Yeah.
What? Why are you looking at something I did when I was 19 and 20, you know, 17 years ago, and it's not relevant? It shouldn't even be in the conversation. So it shouldn't.
Why don't they include just the 10 years of stuff that he's done after his last conviction?
So that it comes with context.
Into the Garda vetting. Yeah. And read the Garda vetting, and then you go on to 2013, James gets into education, he does his level 5, finishes his degree, goes on to do a master's, starts a doctorate, gets a job here.
Yeah.
You know, that's never on
exactly, it. Yeah. And like you say, it just becomes a filter. And I think it's not, I don't think it's always nefarious. Like, I don't think those NGOs probably, like they've probably been advised from a security or a risk point of view to do this, well, you know.
Sometimes it's not the actual people, the people in the organisation, want you.
Yeah.
There's board of management, no, or, you know, boards of directors, or there's legacy policies that are outdated. It was stuff like that, kind of, in my experience. But saying that, I've had a lot of opportunities then where people, like, all you want is for people to hear you out.
Yeah.
So, for example, when I was with, I won't name any organisations, but HR, they were impressed with the interview, and they just wanted to sit me down and talk to me about it. That's all you want.
Yeah, exactly. So you can give some context.
Because if you get to meet somebody, they're going to know, right, there's no risk here.
Yeah, totally.
But a lot of the time, you don't get that opportunity, and that's very disheartening.
Yeah.
You know, as a human, in your office, like, what's the big human rights issues at the moment in the state?
Yeah.
Direct
provision, the immigration system at the moment, and particularly those people who are the international protection system, rather, and those people who are seeking refuge here and not even getting a place to stay. That is a very critical issue right now. I would say the group who are most marginalised in our society are travellers, and the outcomes for the traveller community across all heads, employment, education, health, life expectancy, are just so problematic. I do think that is still Ireland's biggest human rights inequality challenge. But I think the other thing is economic inequality. And I mean, that's one of our strategic priorities, because I think, I mean, we do work a lot on issues that affect marginalised communities and by their very nature, often smaller parts of the population, smaller groups within the population. But economic equality bridges over all of those groups and then some, you know. And I mean, at the moment, I think the deepening inequality is just a huge issue that we have to address. And it's a challenge for organizations like ours. It's a challenge for human rights to address economic inequality, because states are much quicker to correct issues around civil and political rights, for example, because it doesn't cost them anything.
Yeah.
But as soon as you start to try and realize economic, social and cultural rights, it costs state money. Yeah. So we put out a policy statement recently on our vision, which is that ESC rights, economic, social and cultural rights, should be put into the constitution here in Ireland. They're not at the moment. And we particularly believe that the right to housing should be expressed within the constitution. And there is going to be a referendum probably on that. And it's not what people think. Like, if you put a right to housing in the constitution, that doesn't mean that everybody gets a house. And but it does mean that the state has an obligation to better protect vulnerable groups within the housing market or the housing sector. So it places additional obligations on homelessness, responses to homelessness. But also, I mean, we did a report a couple of years ago on with the ESRI around monitoring adequate housing. So really just kind of setting out six criteria which we thought helped to define what is adequate housing. So things like security of tenure, standards of housing and so on. And certain groups come out really poorly across all of those dimensions. So lone parents is one group, for example, disabilities, people with disabilities, migrants, you know, overcrowding, for example, is huge for migrant communities. So those, I think, for me, if we were able to make headway, and certainly in my term of office, I would love to see us make some way headway in terms of just recognition and realization of economic, social and cultural rights. But it's a very hard area to tackle. And one of the things within that we're looking at within this strategic cycle is care. And we're currently running a campaign around this called Care About Equality, where we're naming the unpaid care in society that women mostly undertake and which prevents women from gaining equality within the workplace, but also equality in the domestic domain and within communities. Because that is a real barrier for women in terms of accessing the kind of work that we should be able to work, or should be able to access, and achieving greater economic independence and security the same way that men do, but also advancing within the workplace, you know. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the reality is, for example, that a couple, a man and a woman, say, who are both working outside the home, in paid employment outside the home, still the statistics show us that the woman in that partnership will do double the amount of housework and 50% more of the childcare. So it's not about just, it's no longer about that breadwinner model, you know.
With maternity leave and stuff like that, even though it shouldn't, it affects the prospects for promotion in the workplace as well, even though it shouldn't, it does.
Yeah.
And a lot of this stuff is implicit as well. Like,
do you think we're still, it's still kind of a continuation of the old culture where the woman, do you think we are changing gradually?
We're changing gradually, but way too slow.
Yeah.
So we still live in a patriarchal society, is the way I say it. We have a gender order. Yeah. And we can't, like, you know, and I think particularly around Women's Day, it's great to acknowledge that we're changing and that a lot of men are taking on care roles, which is really positive. But we can't gloss over the fact that we still are living in a patriarchal society and women have a lot more barriers to participation than men do. And personally, and as an organisation also, we support the introduction of quotas in certain situations, which we believe will accelerate and advance women's rights in a way that it's just not going to happen naturally. We would be hundreds of years waiting for the Dáil to have 50-50 representation.
Would have happened naturally if it was
exactly,
going to happen.
Yeah. So you do need to push these things. And absolutely, we all carry patriarchy. We're all a product of this society. So this isn't, you know, when I talk about gender equality, it's not an anti-men message. We all as a society have to look at how women are able to thrive and survive in this society. And at the moment, it's not on an equal footing.
Yeah.
Like you say, in the workplace, for example, like in the countries where there are better balanced parental leave policies for genders. So, for example, in some of the Nordic countries, one parent will get 6 months leave, the other parent will get 6 months leave, and you can't shift it over. So if in that case, again, if it's a man and a woman, the woman might take the first 6 months and then the man take the second. But if he doesn't take it, it doesn't transfer over.
Yeah.
And when that happens, men are forced into care roles. They understand care a lot better. They understand the challenges of being a full-time carer at home.
So you'd be in favour of that?
Something like that, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's the road we're headed down.
I think most Irishmen I think most Irishmen would be delighted to be home.
I don't know about that, yeah.
No, do you know what, though? I will say this, and I wanted to say it. Like, without my wife being in her role at home, we'd be nowhere, myself and the two kids. She's basically the one who runs the whole show.
Yeah.
You know, and you're right. Women do most of the housework and most of the childbearing, and she does her own full-time job then as well on top of that. You know, and it got me thinking. I was sitting here and I was saying, fucking bollocks.
Not just because, like, men, I think as well, like, there is a tendency, oh, well, I do this or I do that.
Yeah.
Women still organise it most of the time. That's the other thing that gets me, that mental labour that we undertake.
For me, it's not that I actually intentionally leave her do all these things. It's just like I'm sitting into a role as being a parent, but I from listening to you now, you kind of you should be actually doing more at home.
Yeah, and instigating it, like that's the thing for I think it's important to acknowledge, is that it's not just about, you know, it's very hard to say, well, I'll do this and you do that. But oftentimes, you know, and I've had men respond to me on this, and they'll say, yeah, but women want to run the place. And no, like, we want to have a balanced, most of us, I think, want to have a balanced relationship or dynamic within any domestic setting, be it with a partner or whatever else your situation is, where everybody pitches in at the same level, you know. And I do think, because the point, going back to that, the parental leave thing, not only does that affect the domestic situation, but that man now goes back into the workplace having had the experience of leave. And as a manager, he's more understanding of what that means. He understands that it affects your visibility, your promotion and advancement opportunities. Because when you have to take mat leave and you have to take other carers leave, because it's not just children that we disproportionately care for, it's older people in our lives and lots of other ways. When you've taken that leave, like, you realize it's really hard to advance in the workplace. And men, when they're forced into doing it, or not forced into it, but when they're legislated to do it, they do start to realise that, and they become better managers, better colleagues as well.
Yeah, to bring that kind of topic into the prison environment, we spoke to a lot of female prisoners over the last few weeks as well. And what you learn is, when the men go to prison, the woman is looking after the kids on the outside. She's passing up the few quid for the runners and the tobacco and visits every week, bring the kids up, getting the kids communions and confirmations and all that. But when the women goes in, the kids go into care, and they don't get anybody calling up to them with runners or money for tobacco or visits or anything like that. They're on their own.
Yeah.
And that's another example of it.
That's sad.
It is.
It's really sad. I think when women go into prison, there is such a greater impact on the people that they are leaving behind, you know. And I think it's very statistically clear that happens. So I do think there has to be ways in which we can improve diversion and ways in which we can avoid women going to prison, because I think the reality is, for many women in Irish prisons, they don't need to be there in many cases.
There was a lady on our podcast recently, her name was Edwina Grossinger. Lady Edwina.
Lady Edwina, she's a...
Oh, yeah, I didn't listen to it yet, but I've seen the episode.
Just in context of what we're saying about women going into prison and the kids being left at home, and then the worry of are the kids okay? I can imagine how that must be for a mother.
Yeah.
But they've recently, they're at the end of construction of a place called Hope Street in Southampton?
Southampton, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Where instead of women having to go directly into prison, they'll get an opportunity to go into this residential facility with their kids.
Fact.
So they can spend their time there. It's open. Yeah. You know, there's therapy there for them. There's a school.
Everything on site.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds absolutely amazing. And this lady's a philanthropist as well. And she's done this on her own back with other people who are helping out as well. And it makes so much sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And I mean, not just for women prisoners. You know, I think, you know, personally it should be. But I do think there is a particular experience of women prisoners, and there should be a particular facilitation to... you know, to keep them in the community and to keep them in their families as much as we can.
Yeah.
We spoke at the Goshka event about the impact of COVID-19 on the prison system.
Yeah.
You want to talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, at the time, I remember hearing all of the statistics, the statistics basically being zero cases and how, well that was celebrated within Ireland as being a success, if you like, for in terms of infection control in the prison system. And I don't think any of us at the time realised how that much that was impacting on prisoners and their families and their communities. And I think that's been, certainly since I've been in this role, something that's come to my awareness, a lot stronger. And I think one of our strategic priorities is future-proofing, we're calling it, but which is, I'm not thrilled with the name, but anyway, it's about saying, like, if we hit crises again, be it kind of a sudden one like COVID or even the longer-running, obviously, climate crisis that we're dealing with, we have to find ways in which when that crisis happens, when emergency powers kick into action, when we deal with things in a way that is out of routine as a state, we have to find better ways of protecting the people who are most vulnerable, because that did not happen in COVID. There was certain, and the voice of prisoners was just not heard. What we heard was the prison system claiming success, yeah. But we didn't hear the other side of that. We didn't hear what that meant in terms of the deprivation of rights that prisoners experienced because of infection control. And I think that's, we can't enter into another crisis with that mindset. We have to be more careful about
what kind of rights was infringed.
Well, I think, the right to family life, and I think this boils down to the kind of the real nub of certainly how I see prisoner rights, is there's still a lack of appreciation, I think, within the general public that when your freedom is deprived, you're not supposed to give up all your rights. Like, that's not what prison is. The punishment is the deprivation of liberty, but that does not mean that you should be deprived of any other rights. So that's the kind of thing that people experienced, was just a lack of connection with their family, a lack of bodily autonomy, and the ability to even access
schools was closed, gyms,
services closed. Exactly. Yeah,
there was 2 weeks quarantine for people coming in isolation, lack of visits, stuff like that.
And the impact on mental health for prisoners is just, for people in prison, is just huge when those things are taken away. So I think those were, those are the issues. But I do think there was additional issues around the emergency powers, how the emergency powers that applied to the prison service were monitored. It was slightly different to that of the kind of legislative powers that were brought in. So there was definitely oversight problems as well. Yeah. That, again, I think we just need to be more watchful of if we're ever going to enter into that kind of a crisis again, where those kinds of measures are going to be taken. We need to be clearer on it. And one of the things that I think is really important is the NPM, the National Preventative Mechanism, which is incoming, although it's been incoming for quite a while now. And we have a role. So as the National Human Rights Institution, we're going to be the NPM coordinator. And that will come into effect essentially when we ratify OPCAT, which is the optional protocol for the Convention Against Torture, and that is a part of the Inspection of Places of Detention Bill, which is currently in the legislative process. So what that preventative, it's amazing to hear people. I was just in Geneva last week and we were talking to kind of our sister organisations in many other countries, and actually the topic was about the prevention of torture and about the NPM structures that many of these organisations are implementing at the moment. And we ratified, or we signed up to OPCAT, to the Convention Against Torture, in, I think, 2008, wasn't it? And then, so it's, I think, 16 years, essentially, before we're now ratifying it. We're one of the outliers. We're one of the last in Europe to do so.
Why does it take so long?
The state has a policy of when they want to sign up to something like an optional protocol, their take on it, their policy is that we have to have all of the legislation and structures in place to operationalize it. I have a problem with that. I challenge that, because we're never ready. And we're saying the same thing with the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. The optional protocol to that is not ratified yet. It will be with the Assisted Decision Making Act that's coming through in April. But those are, I appreciate there's no point in ratifying it and then starting from scratch, but somewhere in the middle, surely, because that delay is just too long, 16 years before we're essentially seeing that. When I was director 8 years ago, when we were starting as IREC, thought we were going to be the NPM immediately. And, it's still in the works. But it is going to make a big difference, because what it will allow for is this preventive mechanism to prevent against torture. So it'll allow for much more wholesome inspections of all places of detention. So there will be an NPM basically a body assigned to each of the different sectors. So the inspection, the inspector of prisons, which will be renamed, will cover the whole justice sector. So they will cover not just prisons, but also
guard stations,
transit, and so on. And then I think HICWA will be looking after direct provision, and the Mental Health Commission, I think, for some institutions. But, you know, like one of our recommendations, for example, is that they can't be too prescriptive within the legislation, because there are places which are de facto places of detention. So, for example, if you're detained at the airport or revenue, you might not be in the list, but we have to have ways in which those places can be inspected as well. And all of the different bodies who are then assigned, they have powers to do announced and unannounced visits to inspect. And certainly from what I'm learning about this from other jurisdictions and other countries is that a huge part of it is the relationships that those bodies build up with the prisons. So like or the other places of detention. Yeah. So it really is quite a collaborative process, and it's a positive process, and it is about prevention. And again, like if those things had been in place, we wouldn't have seen in COVID what we saw with direct provision centres, where there was no capacity for infection control. We wouldn't have seen that that response within the prison system that was so rigid and so kind of extreme. And again, not to take away from the success of infection control within that, but like just there would have been greater consideration of prisoner rights in the introduction of those.
We spoke to somebody recently. They run a hospital, and we were talking about COVID-19 and what it was like in the hospital at the time. And he was on about, you know, for some of the staff that would have been caring for patients in their last hours of their lives, then double body bagging people, the family never get to see them. He said that was overkill. Looking back, in hindsight, it was inhumane.
Yeah.
And it affected the rights of the family. Mm. But you think that in COVID-19 there was such a panic to control the infection that kind of trumped individual rights and family rights?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, for some of those decisions, I just can't imagine what it was like being in those places of decision making, you know, to deal with how to handle a situation like that. So whatever about what happened, I do think it's about how we prepare for the next.
We have to learn from it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think the inquiry, I think it's really positive that the government is looking at that. I do think they need to look at it through a human rights and equality lens and, you know, really think about it in terms of not just the health and medical response, but also what it meant for people and what it meant for infringement of rights for people. Because I do think we need to look at that. So, for example, you know, like I know kids in care, like, you know, there was a lot of talk about education and how kids were able to kind of go online or, you know, and even within that, certain kids could go online if you have, you know, the internet, if you have data, if you have, if you're not like, if you're living in a caravan in a Halton site and you've got, you know, no space, like, you know, there's...
My wife was working in a youth reach at the time.
Yeah.
And the Cork ETB supplied laptops to the young people.
Yeah.
But they didn't have they didn't know how to work the
laptop. Don't have to, yeah, exactly.
And the parents didn't know. Yeah. There were the pressures on the families in at home.
Yeah.
They're opening the laptop and they're, is it on? Do you know?
There was
so many struggles at every kind of... At every kind of solution, there was another problem cropped up. You know? And if
so, certain groups were fine, and as usual, it was the same groups who were not fine. It was people with disabilities, it was travellers, it was people in lone parent families, where what many people see as quite a simple fix and a switch to online learning just wasn't possible.
Yeah.
But then for kids in care, that wasn't just the only thing they lost. They lost not only education but access to key workers, to psychologists. So you know, like, there was totally unseen groups throughout any of the public debate, I think. And that's what I mean when I talk about when we future proof, we need to make sure that we don't lose that again, because if, you know, there will inevitably be more crises. And like I say, some of them will be sudden. But even just thinking about the climate crisis and how we're responding to that, what that's going to mean in terms of jobs and building, you know, we're pushing for a just transition. We've got a policy statement coming out on this. To really kind of, you know, make sure that when we talk about climate, we don't lose sight of human rights and equality, that we make sure that, you know, when we think about displacement of labour, for example, through automation and AI, that we are also considering what that means for people, you know. So I think, there's lots to learn from it.
It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time. Thank you. We covered
a lot of ground. Yeah, cool. That flew in.
Fascinating. And,
I could literally sit here all night and just have a conversation.
This is lovely.
Because there's so much other stuff I'd like to talk about, but I'm so grateful to have you here and to...
Pleasure.
To have a conversation.
Yeah, and thanks for being open about your personal experience.
Oh, no, I'm delighted, actually. It's kind of good to, it's good to
talk about that stuff.
It is. I mean, and
it'll allow other people in a similar position to you to say, do you know what?
Yeah, exactly.
What's wrong with... I know. What's wrong with... It's not really. Like.
Yeah, exactly. Quite the opposite. Yeah. You know, exactly. You get so much from it, you should be able to speak about it.
The amount of people that come in here with little notepads and folders and stuff.
Yeah. Even the Taoiseach. It'd be cool, and he just got chatting, and that was it then. But listen, I hope you enjoy your stay in Cork.
Thank you so
much. Thanks for coming down to me.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.